Holy moly, homies. Do I have a kick-ass episode lined up for you with the incredible Rachel Roberts from the Homeopathic Research Institute. Now, I've been following them for a few years, ever since I watched the documentary Just One Drop. If you haven't watched it yet, make sure you do. So I knew little bits about their work and what they do. But chatting with Rachel today has just highlighted again how important this organization is and how lucky we are as a profession to have them on our team. They are doing incredible work. They're working their butts off to help all of us raise the profile of homeopathy with really, really good homeopathic studies. I really hope you enjoy today's episode. And if you can, please consider donating at hri-research.org or make sure that you follow them on Facebook or Instagram or their YouTube channel. Make sure to sign up for their newsletter. Rachel has got some really exciting news that's coming out in the next 6 months or so, which you do not want to be missing out on. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we get to have an interview with the absolutely lovely Rachel Roberts, who I have been trying to get on the show for a very long time. So this is a dream come true. A very warm welcome to you, Rachel.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to finally be here. It's been a few attempts, as you said, but I'm here now.
You're worth the wait. Many people would know you from the documentary Just One Drop, which is such an epic documentary. I tell you what, it made me so angry at the same time, but also just made me realize we need to really get our butts into gear and really protect this very precious modality that we have. But before we get into HRI and all that good stuff and your conference, can you tell our listeners first about how you were first introduced to homeopathy?
Oh my God, back in the mists of time. Yeah. So the first thing I always almost need to remind myself is that I came across homeopathy in my early 20s when I was what you would now call a skeptic. So we didn't have skeptics back then, but I was a biological scientist specializing in physiology, particularly neuroscience. I was at university in Birmingham in the med school and everything. I actually thought homeopathy was, I usually say bollocks. I don't know if I can say that.
You can say
that. Certainly a load of rubbish. And I used to say that, you know, as far as I was concerned, I knew very little. I just saw headlines in the newspapers talking about really diluted substances. And I remember a day that the lab technician came into the lab and put a newspaper on the desk and said, "I was so stupid, homeopaths again. Look, the queen takes arsenic," was like something like that kind of headline, you know? And I remember saying, "Oh, well, that's complete rubbish. They should all be banned. They're quacks. Haven't they heard of chemistry? Blah, blah, blah." You know, all that stuff, which is just so mortifying now. And I think to go from that to where I am now was quite a hell of a journey, I have to say. But what really kind of spoke to me was in that moment, I thought I knew everything, as you do when you're 21, you know, the arrogance of youth. And I look back and I knew nothing, nothing. I just knew what I'd seen in the newspapers and so on. But because I was having that conversation, I started chatting about homeopathy. Someone said, "You do know that they have hospitals for this." I was like, "What?" I said, "Yeah, bricks and mortar, 5 homeopathic hospitals in the UK back then." I said, "Real hospitals with real doctors in them?" I said, "Yes, prescribing homeopathy." I'm like, "What?" So that was something for me. I was like, I just assumed it was all new age hippies, probably dressed in purple. I don't know what I thought, but certainly didn't think it was hospitals with real doctors in it doing it. So that was the first thing. Then we were talking about the royal family, and I just thought, I'm no big royalist, but they're the richest people on the planet, right? They can have anything they want. And I kind of looked into it, and they've always had a royal homeopath since the 1800s. So I was like, well, that's odd as well. And I just started playing around with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, what if? Still thought it was pretty unlikely. And then it was one of these silly things that happens. My mum had a dinner party and there was a woman there I've known since I was a kid who's extremely intelligent, very normal, and just sat there saying how she'd just been cured by a homeopath. And I was like, oh my God. And I just remember going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I grilled this poor woman, really ruined the dinner party, you know, exactly what was wrong with her, exactly what was she given, why did she go, blah, blah, blah. And it just rattled me because the story shouldn't have been true, you know? And she was totally skeptical. She only went because her daughter nagged her so much, she gave in and went. She didn't even expect it to work. So I thought, well, that doesn't sound like placebo effect. She didn't expect it to work. So it was like this accumulation, you know, lots of little things that just made me go, what if? And the moment I said, what if? I am a scientist at the end of the day and I'm curious. So I remember going into town, going into the biggest bookshop, finding the shelf about homeopathy, which I'd never known was there, just picking up the first book I could find, read it, and it was written by a German doctor. And it was just page after page of cured cases. Very matter of fact, very German, you know, you give this remedy for that and you do it in this way. And if you do that, they get well. And it was kind of telling you how to do it and all these cured cases. And I just thought, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, so step by step, I suddenly went, do you know what? I kind of like to look at this and just see. And that was that. Lo and behold, no more neuroscience PhD. Didn't do that. Went off to homeopathy college. And that was that. So, yeah, kind of. Yeah. And all family thought I'd lost the plot, of course. They actually went, what are you doing? And then not many years later, they were all like, oh, my God, thank God you did.
I mean,
because they get free healthcare.
Yeah. But isn't that the true definition of a scientist? Actually being willing to go and explore something that goes against your beliefs, like actually questioning it instead of just brushing it aside. Like that's the antithesis of science. Science is like, okay, this is interesting. Let's go and explore that.
Absolutely right. And I actually get quite angry about how the word skeptic is now misused and misappropriated, because being skeptical is good. I'm still skeptical. You should be skeptical. You should not take things at face value. But that is not the same as being an anti-homeopathy campaigner who seems to get up in the morning with one goal, which is to destroy homeopathic medicine, which I find bizarre, because obviously nobody involved in this sector is trying to force it on anyone. All we're saying is, here's another toolkit. That's how I see it. You've got your conventional medical toolkit, which is fantastic when it works, and you've got your homeopathic toolkit. Find out which one's going to work for you, and you've got double the chance of people getting better if you've got two toolkits. It's that simple to me. So why try and get that removed for those who want it? It's bizarre to me.
It's very bizarre. And, you know, as homeopaths, we're so interested in the psychology, the reasons behind why people do the things that they do. So
absolutely.
I do find that, and actually I had this chat with Jared and Drinos as well, the psychology behind what drives you in the morning to go and decide, this is what I'm going to do today, is go and try and destroy homeopathy. Why? Haven't you got anything better with your time? Why?
Absolutely. I kind of feel sorry for them, but then that sounds a bit patronizing. I don't mean it to be that. I mean, literally, that's a strange motivation. You know, if we're getting up in the morning thinking we've found something that's quite amazing and we just know it can help so many people, so you want as many people to know about it as possible and try it and see if it will help them. That's a pretty good reason to get up in the morning. Trying to get something removed is odd.
The healer in me feels sorry for them too, because they're clearly hurting. If you're an inspired, abundance-minded person that is there for the betterment of society, I don't know, but maybe they justify it in a different way. But anyway, we should they have their own beliefs,
reason which they will believe in. Obviously, I don't think they're bad people. You know, I think they are. A lot of them are coming from a point of their truth. They honestly think somehow they still think it's a placebo effect, which usually these days means they actually don't know the data. That's the frustration for me. Is if I hear someone now who appears to be scientific saying it's a placebo effect, we know that. It's frustrating because they can't know the data. They can't have read it. Because if you do read the data, you see that's not what the science is saying now. That might have been an argument you could make 30 years ago. But now, if you look at the data, it's saying it's not placebo. So you can have that belief, but it's not an evidence-based belief. So I do say to them, kind of, where have you got that from? Please show me what you're talking about, because that's not the science I'm looking at. And you usually find they haven't looked at the science at all. They've read the Daily Mail, as we have in the UK, or some newspaper, or seen one study that's been hyped to oblivion to sort of say that it, you know, give a negative result or something. It's really not coming from a point of having studied the evidence, which is what a scientist should do for sure. And I think getting into that mindset of why that some skeptics or anti-homeopathy campaigners, as I prefer to call them, are how they are. I have thought about this on a sort of personal level, because I do remember feeling like that. Okay, I wasn't campaigning, but I was in their position mentally, should we say. And I think it could be about what a shock it is to the system to think that you have to throw away everything you know about science. That's what you think, but it's not actually the case. So they're thinking, if I believe homeopathy can work, you've got to forget physics, you've got to forget biochemistry, you've got to forget pure chemistry and so on. And you don't. That was the turning point for me. All you have to accept, I can keep all of that. I can keep everything I know about human physiology and so on. All you have to realize is there could be something else as well. It's not instead of. It doesn't nullify your whole knowledge base. It's an additional element on top. There's something, another way you can get change in the body, another way you can interact with it. As soon as I went to that point, I can keep everything and add to it. Then it wasn't so scary. And I think a lot of the people that I am kind of up against, if we put it that way sometimes, these are often professors, you know, in their 50s, 60s. If you've held a position for decades, I think you can almost be defined by that or feel you're defined by that. And I think they see it as if they look at the data I'm presenting them, even if they know really, it's pretty convincing, which they should if they're being objective. They can't quite let go. It's a big fall off a cliff to them. It would feel like a falling off a cliff or something. And so I feel like maybe the next step for me is to try to have that kind of conversation when they say, no, don't feel that. Just look at it purely objectively as an additional layer.
I like that. And what I always think is the reason why they want to not believe that or don't even want to entertain that idea, it's going to be different. And for each person, yeah, kind of need to, what is it about that? And I'm kind of thinking of my own experience. I used to be very pro-vaccination before I discovered homeopathy. And it was only because I had never actually researched it. I was just regurgitating the information that I had been fed. And once I actually did the research, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like a whole can of worms. And then of course I went on this mission to try and convince everybody else of my beliefs, which I'm so past that now. I'm just at the place of acceptance that we all have different journeys. But yeah, I found that for every person, it was a different thing. For one person, it was that there is monkey cells in it. For another person, it was that there's no placebo trials. For another person, it was like, it's different for everybody.
Absolutely,
but I also
right.
just realized that you use the term anti-homeopathy campaigners. That's AHC, which is one of our best homeopathic combinations, Arnica, Hypericum, Calendula, which is all about healing wounds and just healing general, post-surgery, post, you know, cuts and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a great name. It's got a healing energy to it. So really.
I like that.
Now, we're a few minutes in the chat, but we haven't mentioned Homeopathic Research Institute yet. Tell us about how it got started and what it is and the work that you do, because you're doing incredible stuff. I don't know, I'm sure most homeopaths know about you, but this podcast is 50% homeopaths, 50% listeners, as per our little poll that I did on my Facebook group. So tell our home users, what is the Homeopathic Research Institute?
So the Homeopathy Research Institute, or HRI, as we call it, was established about, where are we? It must be 13 years, 12 years ago, something like that now. So this is a charity set up in the UK to promote high quality research in homeopathy and also to communicate the existing evidence base. So it was founded by Alexandre Tournier, who is a physicist, who then got interested in homeopathy as a sort of secondary step. So he, at the time he set it up, had been working for Cancer Research UK, which is one of the most famous research institutes in the world, doing pure research. So he's 100% a researcher first. He then got interested in homeopathy, did a training course just out of interest, and kind of course, started looking at our research and went, do you know what? It could be better. There is some research, but the quality wasn't great and so on. And he just said, look, there needs to be more research and it needs to be done right. So when I met Alex, which I think was about 2010, and it had been running about for a year and a half, but nobody really knew about it and it wasn't quite getting off the ground. And I was just at the point in my life, I'd been a practitioner. I've had my clinics half the time. I was lecturing, teaching homeopathy the other half the time, but I missed science, to be honest, and I missed research. And I thought, maybe I want to go back to that and do that PhD I never did and so on. And so we then met and I was like, oh my God, somebody else who is really a science brain who happens to love homeopathy too. And it was that combination. So I was coming from, you know, a little bit of a scientific background, but mostly homeopathy. He was mostly science with a little bit of homeopathy, and you put us together and we kind of went, we could really do something here. So that was the driving force of just going, you know, we want to bring that rigor that you associate with top research institute to our homeopathy world. And it was around the same time that the attacks were also getting really bad in the UK. That was not coincidence. It was partly why I shifted as well. Around 2008, it really got bad. And I just remember thinking back then, I felt weird because I had to give up my practice. First, I gave up my teaching because HRI got busier. And then I eventually gave up my practice. That hurt. That was like a wrench. I didn't quite know how to deal with that. But I had to choose because we were getting bigger and bigger and bigger and it needed more and more of my time and became full-time for me. And I spoke to my mum about it. My mum is my go-to person when I want real life advice. And I said, I feel like I'm failing my patients. Like, you know, if I'm not doing this. And she said, it sounds like what you're talking about with HRI, you're helping everybody's patients. You're helping all the patients out there, all the potential patients. So maybe do that for a while and see how it goes. And then if you really feel you're missing your own patients, whatever, you can always go back. Yeah. never went back. So still running HRI. But oh, that's how
for
I
us.
See it. It's like, I'm trying to help, you know, you feel like you're trying to protect it. You're trying to, for me, really test it as well. That's the objectivity part. So I was quite unpopular in the early days of HRI because I was the one saying to the sector, it's not good enough. We need to do better. We need to look at ourselves. We need to iron out some of the things we are not doing as well as we should do. We need to be more professional. We need to be better trained. We need to be, you know what I mean? All these things saying, look at ourselves, be better. Mm. And so then people were saying, I bumped into an old student who said, well, you've sold out. I was like, pardon? People were seeing research as like the enemy, something from conventional science that's there to trip us up or something. I said, absolutely not. You can test homeopathy with really rigorous research methods that come from conventional science. And we can pass that test if you want to see it that way. But that's not how I see it. Alex and I see it as every profession should do this. You should examine yourselves and find out what works, what doesn't work so well, how can you do it better, and so on. So for me, it's really trying to bring all those elements together, the science and the homeopathy in one place.
Amazing. I remember reading somewhere that Alex was going to Switzerland a couple of years ago at a university. Yes. There. Is he still there?
So he moved to Switzerland. I lose track of time so fast. I think it's 3 years.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking it must be. It feels like it was maybe three years ago.
But he's moved around. When we first met, I was in Bristol or Wales. I can't remember. I think I was in Wales and he was in London. So he was London, Cancer Research UK for all that time. So that's how we met in UK. But then he moved to France, then Germany, and now Switzerland. So, you know, we lose track. But the HRI trustees are all over the world and our scientific advisory committee is all over the world. So we've been this kind of virtual organization for many, many years until we had a physical office where I'm sitting right now a few years ago. So we're kind of used to that global virtual way of working. But yeah, he's moved to a great place for him. He's at EKIM, which is the Institute for Complementary and Integrative Medicine at the University of Bern in Switzerland. So he's working directly with Stefan Baumgartner now on a daily basis. And most people in the research world have heard of Stefan Baumgartner. He's an amazing researcher. He's now a full professor, which is fantastic. And he's the world expert in basic research on homeopathy, particularly the plant-based studies. And of course, Alex is now, he'd never say it, but I'm allowed to say it. He is now considered the world expert on the fundamental research in homeopathy. So he's pursuing more theories, possible theories of the mechanism of action. He's looking at replicating these basophil studies that were done decades ago. You know, the ones with the white blood cells where you get them to release histamine and you give them a remedy and they don't release histamine and all that kind of thing. So he is trying to bring, for example, with that project that HRI is funding, he's taking an experimental model done decades ago, which was great, but he's trying to do it with today's techniques, today's equipment, today's knowledge, an expert lab technician and so on, and kind of upgrade it to the modern era. So yeah, really exciting work that he's doing there.
Amazing. You know, we are so lucky as a profession to have minds like yours and Alex's on team, you know. You talked about, you said funding. Where does the HRI get their funding from? Because you've got a physical building there. You have got people working for you. You fielding off, you know, attacks from skeptics. And when Jerry Dendrinos reached out to you with the NHMRC report here in Australia, you put countless hours into that. Somebody's got to pay for your time. Where does the funding come from?
Absolutely. Since the inception of HRI, the absolute bulk of our money has come from a single individual called Charles Wainsborough. Can you imagine? It's like, I know I want to do name check Charles. He's an amazing individual. I get like goosebumps thinking about Charles because a true philanthropist, you know, he met Alex. He was lecturing in homeopathy, met Alex as a student, and they were chatting. And Alex had no idea that Charles Wainsborough is a very wealthy man. So they were chatting and he was going, oh, I really wish there was an institute, da da da. And Charles really enjoyed that because he knew Alex didn't know who it was. So he's going, really? Alex, what would you do if you had the money? And all. So he's spouting off ideas and da da da. And he went, okay then. So what do you mean, okay then? He said, and the story I heard was he gave Alex a check in those days for £20,000 and said, go on then, do it. And Alex was like, okay. So he had to find somebody, he's a physicist, right? So he had to find an organized person, a lovely woman called Arlene Lyne, who was his first helper, shall we say, who actually created the structure, the charitable structure, got charitable status, registry, and all of that stuff, and got him off the ground. And then when I came on board, Charles is a very sharp man. And I remember him bit by bit saying, okay, here's a bit more. Let's show me what you can do with it. And that's how it worked. And we had to prove ourselves each time. And if Charles was happy with what we were doing, we got some more. And it got to 2013, and we did our first international conference, which was a huge risk because we had no idea if it would work. Even Peter Fisher, who I adored, said to me, Rachel, love what you're doing, but this is ambitious because you're a niche within a niche. You can't do a conference just on research. Mm. You know, these days it's hard to get people to come to homeopathic conferences. You need to be like an add-on, just do a day attached to another conference. But Alex and I were like the same vision, like, no, it deserves its own platform. And if it's not there now, we'll create it and people will come or they won't. And then we had a lot of sleepless nights, but thank God they came. And it was a huge success. Charles was there. He'd come to see what we were doing. And he came up to me after the gala dinner, said, okay, then well done. I'll fund you for 5 years. So you can stop worrying about where the next bit of money will come from and you can do some work and get on with it. And then we were lucky later on, we got other major donors, of course. Once you can concentrate on the work, then they will come to you. And we've been so lucky that various people have said, okay, now we know what you're doing. It happened at this our latest conference only a few weeks ago, June this year, that another gentleman, of course, I can't name, he represents a foundation in France. And he came up, he's known Alex for years and given a little bit of support. But he said to both of us, I've watched you now for 2 days. Now I get what HRI is. Now I get what you do. Why haven't we been more behind you? I'm giving you 20,000 euros for your next conference. And of course, these conferences cost. I've just done the budget. It's a lot of money, huge budget to do it at the level we do it. So that's already, you know, pledged for our next conference. So that's how it works. Yeah.
I have got all over goosebumps.
Yeah. And that's why I feel so privileged. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's why I feel like I can only do what we've done and we can only do what we've done because those people. And you're right. Once you have an office and the people we use, I mean, that's another thing I'm really proud of. And I'm sorry, I get all like a proud mum with HRI, but yes, we have Alex's time. He is an unbelievably qualified researcher. We have Dr. Angelina Moseley, trained at Cambridge University, immunologist, again, career scientist before she came to HRI. Then we have now Dr. Esther van der Werf, who's got 25 years of doing trials in complementary medicine all over Europe. She's a world expert on AMR and women's health and so on in research. Like, you want people at that level. And that's what I said a few years ago. So we have to have the best because of what we do. What we do has to be as good as we can possibly make it. We're not perfect. We'll make mistakes like anyone, but we need it to be that level. So there is a bit of a thing. We had a team meeting recently that I am a little bit like everything to be spot on. So we're saying, how can we do better? And everyone said, you could stop making us make every absolute goddamn thing be perfect.
Everybody needs one of those on the team.
I will work on that. But that, yeah, that's what I'm proud of. And of course, you need to pay salaries for people. That's why we need major donors. Do you know what I mean? So occasionally people say to me, is there any point me giving you a little bit of money? And what I'm really, really proud of as well is that over the last few years, we've seen a big growth in what I call normal donations. And they're the ones that really give me goosebumps because I have Chris Connolly, our communications manager, who does amazing work with all our nice shiny comms. And he's the one that goes in the system and can tell me all about the little donations, people who give us £10 a month or £20 a month, or just occasionally give us £50 or something. And I wait till it builds up, until it's enough for us to do something tangible with it. So every now and again, I say, how much is in the pot? It's like looking under the sofa. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And he said the other day, I said, how much? So there's one point I asked that question, we had £4,500. There was another time I asked that question, we had £7,500. You know, those are the years. Those moments, then I go, okay, what can we do? So at the conference in London, it was so nice to be able to say to people, there was a poster being presented, which was a scoping review of how much can homeopathy help with fevers? So it was a review of just what studies do we have and what were the outcomes from all these studies. And we'd paid for that study to be done. That's what we used that money for, to get that study done. And that was actually working with Sabina Vatter at the Aurum Project in Australia. Yes. So, you know, that's how you fund pieces of research and collaborations at an international level, based on someone putting their hand in their pocket and giving us £10 or whatever it is. Do you know what I mean? That's how it really does make a difference. So that kind of keeps me going. When I see that come in, I know I can do something with it. It's really exciting.
And it really does add up, you know, like there's so many of us, everybody just gives a little bit. And before you know it, like you say, it's $7,000 and it might sound a lot to some and not that much to others, but that is a research paper that you can show.
Exactly.
There's more backing behind us, you know, that really adds up.
Exactly.
I just quickly want to put in there for the listeners who don't know, Dr. Peter Fisher that you spoke about before was the homeopathic physician for the Queen for many years until he was run over on Ride Your Bike to Work Day by a bus. It's just
absolutely
crazy.
In central London, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I'd had lunch with Peter just a few days before, and he was such a supporter of HRI. He was one of the original people involved. So another thing we often have to clarify is the word institute. So yes, we now have an office, which is very exciting. We now, in fact, have a little office next door for me to use sometimes, which is great. But for most of our history, we were entirely virtual. We went the other way around for most people. We were home working and went to an office, not the other way around. So I think you're using the word institute. So some of the people who attack us say, oh, you're pretending to be something you're not. We're like, no. It's not about size. It's not about money. It's about UK law. In UK law, the word institute is a protected term. So when Alex was setting this up and he wanted to be where we are now or even further, you know, and he had that vision and he had to fight for that term. So he went out and he got backing from Peter Fisher, probably the most famous homeopathic physician in the world and the expert on the research. And he got Dr. Elizabeth Thompson, who some people will know, who also extremely experienced in clinical research and working in the hospitals in the UK. So with their endorsement, and I think also Dr. Claire Relton, who some people know, I think she came on slightly after them, but very close around that time. So with those people behind it, he could get the word institute because it means you have that level of expertise in your organization. And that's why we're so careful who we hire, because we have to maintain that expertise. So Peter has been in there from the beginning. And yeah,
I'm
just
sure
one of those.
He's
amazing,
still there with you.
People. I still miss him. I still feel like he is. Yeah.
He's absolutely there all the way. I'm convinced he's still there. I think a lot of these greats, and especially the last couple of years, we've lost quite a few homeopathic greats, and they're still all with us. They're with us in our Materia Medica and our lectures. Spiritually, they're all here still doing hard work, as you know, most homeopaths are workaholics. I'm sure they're still in the third realm workaholic.
I think we're the most pathological people in terms of not looking after ourselves. Do you know what I mean? All the stuff we tell everybody else to do.
It's funny, not funny, but yeah, it's funny because it's true. And tell us a bit about the conference, because I know Lily Jordan, I've been in touch with recently, and she was, you know, shared on the Aurum Project about Celeste Salter that went over there as well. Tell us about the conference. So what were you presenting there? What was it like? Who went along and what happened?
Yeah. It's great. So like I said, we've done these since 2013. It's every other year normally. So this was our fifth one. Like everybody, we had a gap because of the pandemic. So instead of every 2 years, we had this 4 year gap from 2019 to the recent conference. And that made it extra special. Apart from that, we all felt kind of rusty. We're like, why do we do this again? But each of our conferences brings together the best researchers in the world, and we're really proud of that. And we always have people from around 30 countries. We obviously check every time, and it's like 26, 28, 30, around there. And that's in terms of both speakers and delegates over the years. So bringing everyone together like that once every 2 years in one place from Thursday evening to Sunday lunchtime, lots of excellent food and wine, lots of excellent science, lots of partying. It just cements the sector, you know, the research sector. And we also have all the heads of all the other parts of the sector. So we'll have the patient groups, we'll have the doctor homeopaths, the non-doctor homeopaths, we'll have everybody there learning from each other. So it's a very, very special environment. And this year, we always look for what's unique to each conference. There's always something. And this time we realized that it was a complete blend of the kind of mature part of the sector, the experience. So we would have keynote speeches from Professor Jennifer Jacobs, from Professor Ubi Adler from Brazil, so that's the US and Brazil, Professor Stephen Baumgartner, and so on. Decades of experience, right? These are the guys who've done it all before, know how to do it. And then we had the newbies, which I love. We had these young researchers who've just done their PhDs, showing their projects all at the same time and mingling and teaching and learning from each other. So that was really, really exciting.
Wow. And this is all homeopathic research?
All homeopathic research.
What?
All of it.
And what are some of the
plant topics? Studies, lab studies, cell studies, gene expression studies. We have strawberries. We obviously have humans. We have veterinary. We had double-blind RCTs. We had observational studies. all of it mixed together. And that's another thing that's unique that even the researchers aren't used to, because they're used to being in their own lane, right? So they would usually only mingle with other chemists or physicists or cell biologists and so on. And a few of them came up to me and said, "This, I've never seen this done in any other sector. You're mixing us all together and we're talking to each other and we're literally, there's, I was going to say cross-contamination. I don't mean that. Cross-pollination. You know, between the clinical researchers and the lab researchers. So they're going, I get that result in my fish. I get that in my humans. And they're talking to each other and really informing each other's studies. So that's exciting. And I've been told several times, when we look at the amount of work we do to create these things, it's huge. The hours is huge. The money is huge. Is it worth it? Even every 2 years. And several people have said to me, please, please, please don't stop, because it is where a lot of these groundbreaking collaborations do get born. So some people might have heard of Stephen Cartwright in the UK, who HRI supported completely from the beginning. Charles basically paid for his research fully for 5 years at the beginning. He's doing amazing work with these solvatochromic dyes, basically dyes that will change color in the presence of certain substances according to their polarity. So he's been doing that again for like 10 years. He met Professor Leonie Bonnemann from Brazil at one of our conferences, who is actually has a background in veterinary medicine and research, and then got into in vitro research. They met. She's now using his techniques in her studies in Brazil, and they're co-publishing. So if we hadn't done our conferences, they'd never have met, and so on. So proper incubator for new research.
We are very lucky to be able to do so much online, but I do think some magic happens when people meet up in person. So we're about to organize, well, we're just at the very start of organizing a conference in Bali next year. Myself and
homeopaths.
Yes. It was on purpose. Yeah. I'm really excited. You know, we're just in those planning stages at the moment, but we just want there to be as much mingling as possible and lots of time of people, of homeopaths getting together. We can create magic when we pool our resources, you know.
I know a couple of people said to me that they were leaving with this, you know, renewed sense of purpose, sometimes literally new ideas for their experiments. Well, that's great, you know, but also this sort of more fundamental feeling of renewal. And then say, yeah, that's going to go away for another 2 years, or go back to their clinics or their labs and then come back again for a refresh in 2 years' time. And I think everybody needs that balance of time alone to do your own stuff and stay in your own head, and then times where you need to come together and just support each other.
Absolutely. Now, the old placebo thing, you know, we just hear that all the time. It's like a broken record. Can you give us some advice? So all the homeopaths that's dealing with this homeopathy as a placebo, have you got like a definitive answer we can just give these AHCs?
Yeah, I would like to say, well, that's bollocks. Sorry. But I probably wouldn't say that. Yeah, we do still get this argument that it's just a placebo effect. And so my answer to that, first of all, if people want something just to show people, it all depends, you know, what situation you're in. If you just look on the HRI website and you go to resources, HRI films, I don't know if you've ever seen it with this little clip. It's just like 4 minutes or something. And we filmed it at one of our conferences deliberately. And we asked that question to all these people like Stefan Baumgartner, Leonie Bonnemann, what do you say? So it's a little clip. And I'm on there as well, but it's mostly these great scientists talking about this. So that's really good. I've shown that to a few people and they've gone, oh, wow, okay. You don't always have a film to hand. So what I do say to people is, please don't just believe what you read in the newspapers. Please don't just believe what you hear. If you talk to the scientists who have done the research on homeopathy, all of them have started off questioning whether it's a placebo effect. Of course, that's the first thing you look at. And all of them have asked that question and answered it, saying it isn't. The data says it isn't. And what I mean by that is we now are at this position of being able to look at different types of research. And if you look at them collectively, it's all pointing in one direction. It's away from placebo. So on the one hand, you have Stefan Baumgartner's experiments from Switzerland with plants. So the classic one a lot of people might have heard of is with duckweed, these small plants. It's a very simple concept. He poisoned them with arsenic, not enough to kill them, just to stress them, as they say, to make them sick. Randomized them, split them into two groups.
Crude dose arsenic, not homeopathic.
Yes, literally crude arsenic. Rat poison, arsenic. Yeah. So made these poor plants sick, but didn't kill them. That must have taken a while to figure out the dose. Put them into two groups. Half of them he gave arsenicum, homeopathic arsenicum that shouldn't have anything in it. And he gave the other half water. He just did it placebo controlled, randomized the whole thing, two groups of plants, and then measured the growth rate. And what you would find, which we would expect, is that, of course, the plants treated with the homeopathic medicine arsenicum, the growth rate improved, they recovered, whereas the ones given water didn't. Now, I'm yet to find an anti-homeopathy campaigner who can tell me how that's a placebo effect. I'm interested. I'm open. You know, give me some ideas here, because that doesn't sound right to me. And then if you take it all the way to the other end of the spectrum and think about human health and clinical trials, we have the best study ever done so far to me and Alex, which is Robert Mathis's systematic review that he did in 2014. And he took all the trials looking at individualized homeopathic treatment, as we would think, gold standard care, you know, proper practitioner prescribing individually, all of that, compared to placebo. So that, again, these were double blind, randomized clinical trials, the exact same method you use for drug trials. And he looked at 22 of those, put them together and summarized them, which is what you're meant to do, the systematic review and meta-analysis. And when he did it, the outcome was definitively positive. It was very, very clear that when you look at those 22 trials together, individualized medicines work 1.5 to 2 times better than placebo. So I have to hesitate when I say that, because I have to get it right, because he's a stickler. He's, again, a very rigorous scientist. And it's specifically when the medicines are individually prescribed. That's what he was looking at, of course. Then they're 1.5 to 2 times better than placebo, which, yes, not consistent with it being a placebo effect, quite clearly. So we have all this evidence. And of course, there's, you know, if you think of conventional medicine, you have over-the-counter medicines, you go to the pharmacy, you might get a bit of advice from a pharmacist, or you go and see your doctor or your specialist. It's exactly the same in homeopathy. We have over-the-counter products, which has also been tested and repeatedly found to be better than placebo. But we also have this kind of specialist care, like I've just described, where you do need to see a practitioner and get the full treatment. So the research has looked at these different types of homeopathy, and really, overall, it's pretty convincing.
Incredible. And how can people access the research that you do? And I'm just trying to understand, because there's loads of homeopaths in India and, you know, all over Europe and in Australia doing research. Do they all contact you for advice? And if you want to get hold of their research, can you get that hold of that through you? Like, where do we find the body of research? Is there like one place where you can find it?
So that's a really good question, because, of course, actually what I should, to sort of lead to that, I should actually talk about the limitations as well. You know, I talk about the strengths of it because that's obvious, but to also respect the limitations of the research we have right now. Not all of it is good quality. That's true. Like any field, some of it's good, some of it's bad, some of it's in the middle. And also why some people won't yet say they're convinced is because we have a scattered evidence base. I don't know if you ever noticed this. If you just look, for example, at the allergic rhinitis data we have for hay fever and similar allergies, I think it's something like, off the top of my head, so I could be slightly wrong, but something like 16 different studies. That sounds quite good. They're all doing different remedies in a different way against a different control group. And you're like, that's the problem we have. So it's not that the data isn't there, it's that it's not focused enough. So if you're coming from the outside and you want proof, they'll say, well, that study hasn't been repeated 3 times. You're right. That's what we need to do next. So we need to focus, we need to replicate these studies. So I just wanted to give a nod to that. And also just about these quality issues. At HRI, we only talk about high quality studies. Mm-hmm. So on our website, you won't find nearly as much research as you'll find somewhere else. So on our website, if it's on our website, we try to make sure it's been absolutely quality checked first. That's a big job that Angelina Mosley does for us, and now Esther van der Werf as well. They will screen all the studies that they find every 3 months, what's been published. And if it's good enough, it goes on our website. So for people to find those, the obvious way is you sign up to our newsletter. It only comes out 4 times a year, so we don't bombard people. And in there, there's a couple of links that say recommended reading. It's a lot more than it sounds. That's the ones we've picked out for saying, look, these are really interesting for some reason. You know, they're interesting and they're high quality. Those will then live forever on the HRI website. So again, you go to resources, recommended reading, and you'll just find loads of studies there, but they've all been quality checked first. So that's what I suggest people do.
That is.
And actually, sorry, you did ask about the other research groups and so on. Yes, we are a kind of hub now in the homeopathy research world, which we feel is a real privilege. So one thing we do, which I really really feel is valuable is we have this scientific advisory committee. People can send us protocols if they're about to start a study or thinking of doing a study. This for me is the best use of our resources. Find the problems before you start, not afterwards, you know? So people can send us their protocols and we can check them and say, look, actually it'd be better if you did it this way, or maybe you need more participants, or we suggest you add this element to it or use this outcome measure and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's an increasing part of what we do, is giving advice both about scientific quality and strategy to get the best research done. And I hadn't realized until recently that there was a misunderstanding about our strategic aim, saying that we promote high quality research. Someone has said, yeah, but you just talk about research, right? I went, what? No. Oh, promote, like PR. So, no. We do promote it, but we mean promote in the widest sense of that word. We will use all our resources to push and create and generate and promote, in that sense, high quality research. So this kind of work where we're helping people get studies off the ground, we might say, look, you really need a statistician on this. We know a statistician, you could reach out to them, they might help you, and that kind of thing. So that's what we mean by promoting high quality research.
That's interesting. I was just interviewing Jesse Coleman today, and they're about to do a research survey type thing. They're just going through the ethics committee. So I must actually ask her if they've been in touch with you guys yet.
Absolutely. Just in case. I mean, it's lovely when we can just say, fantastic, go, you know, fab. That's lovely. But just occasionally, you know, sometimes you just find something they haven't thought of, you know.
Absolutely. And you've got those, like you said, there's excellent resources there. Like, why wouldn't you make use of it? So that's great. I really hope that more of our homeopaths get in touch with you that are interested in doing more research. Is there any particular area of homeopathy or any particular disease or any particular study that you would really see come out, or that you really think is going to make a big difference to convince AHCs?
No, that is such a good question. So it's kind of funny. I had a meeting, it's a long time ago now, actually, it could even be 10 years ago, I'm not sure, something like that, 8, 10 years ago, with a director of Public Health England, official government head of Public Health England. Not at all nerve-wracking. And, you know, was there to say, look, what you've been saying about homeopathy isn't true. We had, I think her name is Dame Sally Davis, who was our chief scientific officer at the time for the UK, had gone on TV on the BBC and said that homeopathy was placebo or something like that. And I just remember thinking, no, not okay. So we tried to see her and we got her deputy, basically. And I remember being in that meeting with this guy just saying, she can't say that because it's not evidence-based. It's just not true. And that's an issue. You know, people will believe her. So we got into it a little bit. I showed him various stuff. He was, of course, said as little as possible. And so I got kind of frustrated. So at the end of it, I said, okay, what would convince you? I asked exactly that question. He went, what? I mean, what do you mean? I said, no, you tell me. Tell me what you want. Do you want an RCT? Do you want an observational study? Do you want this disease? Do you want that disease? Tell me, and I'll try and get it done. And he looked terrified.
They don't really want to. They want to be convinced, really. It's so
exactly.
Much easier staying in your own paradigm.
Yeah, I should have asked this earlier, you know. And then I said, I think, you know, I do deserve an answer to that question. It's a quite straightforward question. You're saying this isn't enough to convince you, so you tell me what is. And it was so predictable. He said, oh, well, I suppose a large double-blind randomized control trial on, you know, a physical disease. He didn't say ear infections, but something like that, he probably would have said, do you know what I mean? And it's so predictable. So I do know that still to this day, what a lot of people want. And when they say large scale, these days, people probably want more than 400 people in it, 500, 600, 800, these kind of things, these kind of numbers. And again, a limitation of homeopathy research is that purely due to funding issues, a lot of our studies, or most of our studies, are smaller than that. Mm-hmm. They're often around, you know, 60 people, 80 people, 150 people. We might get to 200 people, you know, and this is as simple as each participant costs a certain amount for the trial. The bigger it is, the more expensive it is. And if you want to do, let's say, a double-blind RCT on treating sinusitis in a good university with good scientists done the proper way, we're talking about, if it's got 400 people in it, something like £1 to £2 million.
Wow. That was my next question, is like, what is it going to take to make this happen?
Yeah. So It's not at all undoable. Mm. It's purely money. And when you look at, again, people say, well, homeopathic manufacturers should just do it. You know, there's plenty of money or whatever. I've then tried to explain it to some of my normal friends who are in normal businesses, you know, and understand market forces, et cetera, and said, do you realize the problem here? The remedies are already in the public domain, have been for 200 years, most of them. You cannot patent them at the end. So you're asking them to put multiple millions on the table for one study, for each remedy, which they then can't patent. And everybody gets to use it and benefit from it. Would you do that if you were running that business? They go, oh, no, we wouldn't do that. So, yeah, and the drug companies can because they will own it. And, of course, they have the billions to play with. They can do massive trials, you know, so it's very easy. So there is a very pragmatic, boring element to this, which is just about money, you know, at the end of the day.
And there's a part of me that thinks apparently there's like 500 million of us around the world that use homeopathy, right? Like about 500 million people. If we all put in a couple of bucks, we can make this happen.
Exactly. You go around with a bucket.
Yeah.
It could be a good bucket, but it would work. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the frustration sometimes for us is we're going, do you know what? And the other thing that really drives me crazy, when we do get a study done and it's perfectly good, they say, oh, it was funded by, I won't name one, by a homeopathic company. Doesn't count. Funding bias. It's biased because it was funded by a homeopathic manufacturer.
But right? Every single pharmaceutical trial is funded by a pharmaceutical company.
I know. It's amazing.
See, the thing is, like, what's good for the goose should be good for the gander. Like, you can't just like cherry pick stuff and keep changing the goalposts. It's so unscientific.
I did say once, pick a lane, right?
Yes. Just
have a go at us for this app, but really, this is getting silly now. Like, do you trust the research or not? Do you trust funded studies or not? We really need a level playing field. It's getting a little bit absurd. So I'm kind of at the point now where, you know, earlier on we used to avoid any studies funded by industry. We were trying to be super clean, do you know what I mean? And kind of be better than everybody else. And I'm like, come on, actually, we don't need to do that. If it's done well and it's transparent, it counts.
I love this saying, if you try and please everybody, you end up pleasing nobody. And you know what? You're never going to please them anyway. So might as well just do whatever you feel is going to have the biggest impact and go with that, because this whole witch hunt is getting ridiculous. Like, same with doctors or surgeons that say homeopathy doesn't work, but oh, don't take your remedies before your surgery. It's like, well, you said it doesn't work. So what do you care if they take it or not?
Exactly.
You care.
Exactly. I know. It's really, yeah. I mean, can't have it both ways, right?
Like, please tell me you do have some like systems in place for yourself to like de-stress, because when I became awake and realized this whole scam with vaccination, for example, I was trying to convince the world, and I think I just like really affected my health by being on Facebook groups trying to convince trolls that, you know, vaccination is bad. And I was the president of the Immunization Awareness Society in New Zealand for a couple of years as well. And it drove me nuts. It was just like, how, it's like banging your head against the wall every single day. You've been doing this for 13 years now. How are you still sane?
You've asked my family, they're sane. She's gone. No, it is not easy, actually. No. You're right. It's kind of, you know, we laugh about it because it's not a laughing matter. It's really stressful. And the stuff that's written about me online is horrendous. I remember a family friend just going, my God, I don't know what you do, but you've pissed off a lot of people. It's like some people really don't like you. And yes, we've made some big enemies, you know, and we're aware of that. So like you said, I try to stay offline as much as I can. As you said, HRI does not engage with social media in that way. We put out our own social media, but we won't get dragged into things because we know it doesn't work and it's very bad for the soul. So we don't, but it is difficult. And I think there have been moments where I've just thought, is this worth, you know, are we helping? And so I need our conferences actually sometimes to be reminded that what we're doing is making a difference and is helping people. And during the pandemic, of course, like a lot of people, you've far too much time to self-reflect and we're all cut off from each other. And I did think, should we carry on? Da-da. And then something always comes up, if it ever even enters my mind, something then happens. And the problem is I can never talk about the most exciting stuff, right? Because it's confidential and it's coming. But what I can tell you is, so I got involved in a particular project recently where I just went, that's what I'm for. You know, that feeling of this is why I'm meant to do this.
Yeah.
This is what's coming. And it is coming. It should hopefully be, I think we're about 6 months away from being able to talk about that one. And I just feel like, yes, Rachel, that's, you know, do not walk away from this, because
this is the prize.
I think it happens every few years. You have something like that that just sort of re-galvanizes you and says, okay, it is worth it. And the other thing I'm so grateful for is the little HRI team. We are so small. It's another thing people can say, who do I speak to in your marketing department? And I laugh, you know. Well, that used to be me. At least now it's Chris Connolly. But if you add all of us up, we are still only 4 full-time people. If you add up the part-time and full-time people, it's 4 of us, not a lot. But again, the quality of the people, I don't just mean their expertise. I mean the people, who they are. They are amazing people. And I had Esther here. She lives in Bristol. So Esther van der Werf, the epidemiologist, she came up for 2 days to work with me last week. And we made so much progress and we could green light 3 more projects, and so exciting. So the pleasure I get of working with good people, that for me, weirdly, is a stress relief. Just I mean, doing good work kind of is.
You know, it sounds like this whole project has been, I don't know, it's got Samuel Hahnemann or all the greats like stamp of approval on it. It sounds like they have come in kind of like manifesting and moving this. It sounds like it's just been held by, I don't know, universal consciousness or whatever you want to call it. It's been held and it's been propelled forward by the good work that you're doing. I mean, I do believe in karma. And I do believe in good deeds that get rewarded. And what you're doing is amazing and it's wonderful.
Well, that support
is really so much. Thank you
to everyone. You know, it does. So yeah, hopefully we could keep doing what we're doing and keep making a difference. And like I said, I think the other thing that gives me hope, should we say, because you do feel like you have to feel hope that when you're trying to change a paradigm, right, you're literally going against the grain in every single way. You have to have hope. And the hope for me right now comes from the fact that I do see shifts in society, partly pandemic related, of people looking at science in a different way, looking at how the media and politics and science, where they meet and merge and go, actually, it all gets really messy.
Yep.
I've seen a shift in some people who've known me for years who couldn't quite get what I was saying.
Yes.
They would say, Rachel, I hear you. I trust you as an individual. But if it worked, nobody would have a problem. If you really had the data, people would accept it. And I said, you'd think so. I thought that 15 years ago. I now know it's not that simple. The politics that's at stake, the money that's at stake, there's a lot of vested interests. Then COVID comes along, and I'm not going to get into that debate, but it made people realize that they said, here, we're following the science. Well, whether they did or didn't follow the science, I would say is questionable. And people started to see that it wasn't black and white, that it's not yes and no with science. It's murky and gray and political. So now when I say homeopathy is not getting a fair hearing in the media, we do have data, but it won't be published and they won't hear it. People now believe me in a way they didn't pre-2020. So that's sort of helping. It's like the zeitgeist is shifting in a way that's helpful to us. And also conventional science is, I don't want to say it's crumbling, but it's crumbling a little bit in some
cracks
ways.
Are showing. The cracks,
exactly.
You know, the emperor's naked. The emperor's.
Exactly.
I love that. You know, the emperor's new clothes story. I'm just like, he's butt naked, everybody. And people are like, oh, yeah, I see it too.
So I'm trying to say to people, look, we don't need to convince people in that way. We don't need to say how bad some things are in conventional research. People can see it for themselves. Let them get there themselves. Keep doing what we're doing. Just stay here. It's coming to us. Do you know what I mean? Just do what we do. Our time will come.
Well, it's here. I'm feeling it every single day and it's amplifying at a very satisfying speed that I'm quite excited
right.
with. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Anyway, I just won't go, but lots of personal experiences of people that I'm just like, oh, I'm not even going to go down that track with you because I see you so not ready for it that I'm now like, oh my gosh, how did I not see this coming? And that's amazing. Rachel, before we finish off, I'm a little bit sad it's come to an end because I've looked forward to seeing you with you for so many, many, many months. Can you tell our listeners just again, like, how can they support you? Is there anything else they can do to promote your work or to just somehow support and hold and, yeah, give a bit of a hand with what it is that you're doing?
Thank you. Well, thanks for that, because yes, we do need it. Our team does need support. And actually, the first and most important thing I would say is to spread the word. We do our best to put really good quality material out there on social media. And the real challenge, we hope we do it well, is to take this very complex stuff, these scientific studies, and put them out there in a way that is accurate, but people can understand it. So we kind of, sounds awful, but we try and dumb it down in a way that doesn't lose quality, but everyone can understand it. Now, if we've put something out on social media, we would just love it if people do the obvious like and share and propagate it. We need that amplification of what we do. And we know these days, sad as it might be to many of us, if something isn't widely seen on social media, it almost doesn't exist. You know, so I think even if there's, say, people in the homeopathic sector who don't like social media, if they could just see it as helping. Just go in, look at the HRI stuff and push it and then come out again. Do you know what I mean? It's not, you don't have to live in it and even, you know, endorse it in that way, but you could just help fuel our fire. Do you know what I mean? Just by pitching in. And then the obvious second thing, of course, we're a charity, these donations, if anyone feels able to give us something small that we could put in that pot to try and grow the next pot, because I've just spent the last one. The projects that Esther and I gave a green light to a few days ago, we'll have to start building up the next fund to see if we can do something new. So obviously on our website, there's an obvious support HRI button, and anything people can send us, it just kind of gives us a good feeling and enables us to do more work. So we'd love that.
Yeah, as you're talking, I'm just seeing this vision. We need to get you on the Joe Rogan podcast. He needs to, somebody big, like, so. And actually Matt Pepe, it was funny, I interviewed him before and he said that you're friends. I said to him, because, you know, he had Coldplay endorse his book, but we need to get some big celebrities talking about homeopathy and talking about the research and tweeting these things and getting it out there. So like, I'm manifesting that at the moment. We need some big ass names to get behind homeopathy and stop being scared. We know you guys use it. Like, stop being scared of saying that. It's, you're allowed to come out of the closet. It's okay now.
You know? A really, really good message, because you're right. We literally know who they are. Every organization in homeopathy has that list of celebs that we know.
Yeah.
And so few of them are able to come forward. And it's usually their agents saying, are you insane? You know, this is going to be a problem for you. But just like we know there are loads and loads of scientists we've all met who say, we totally know it works, we just can't say anything. So you're right, there has to be that bravery. And with the scientists, it tends to be people who are already professors or close to retirement who can do it. Similarly with celebs, they need to be so famous that it doesn't matter, do you know what I mean, that they can take it if there's any issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Rachel, it's been so amazing. Let's do it. Let's do it. We'll hold that collective vision. One last little question. So what are all the socials that you're on so people can subscribe to your newsletter? They can go to your website. What other places can they follow you to make sure they're not missing out on anything?
Yeah, so we have obviously Facebook, because we're that old. Yeah, so we have Facebook, we have LinkedIn, we have Instagram, and via the website you should see everything. Oh, YouTube. YouTube's the other one. We're putting more and more of our stuff on YouTube for obvious reasons. Yeah, get into all of them. Let's see our numbers go up.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Thank you so much for coming on today. You have completely made my day, my week, my entire month. I cannot wait to get this episode out for our listeners to enjoy. And I just want to see them all rally behind this and just get the show, just show off this beautiful research that we do have and support this incredible organization with these incredible people. I mean, how much more qualified do you want the people on your team to be? Everything is there. It's a winning formula. And I'm super excited to hear about this news that you've got up your sleeve in the next 6 months. Yeah, so
I was going to say, I'll have to tell you when it comes out.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm going to make sure I am following you everywhere anyway. But yeah, I'll definitely be listening out for that advice.
Oh, yeah,
that
hopefully. I mean, you should hear. If you don't hear, I've done something very badly wrong.
We've been shadow banned. They like to do that sometimes too.
They do.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and have an amazing holiday you're about to hit off.
I will do. Now's the time for some R&R. Absolutely. R&R. I need the sand, I need the beach, I need t-shirts and flip-flops. That's what I need.
Is it too early for wine in the UK yet? What time?
Almost, yeah. I think we're already on lunchtime.
Okay, good.
This evening. This is my last day at work. 5 p.m. I think I might even open a bottle of wine at 5 p.m.
Do it. You have my permission. And turn Thanks off all so your well. Devices and make sure you just have a full-on beautiful recharge.
I will. Thanks so much. Lovely to be here.
See ya.
Bye-bye.